We've been reading about the meeting of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. after meeting Lord Chaitanya in Puri, Sarvabhauma, who was like a professor of philosophy, a staunch upholder of Vaibhav philosophy, became sympathetic to Lord Chaitanya's position as a young and very good-looking sannyasi, and thought, how is this young man going to maintain his vow of renunciation without having a firm grounding in philosophical understanding of Vedanta, or conclusive spiritual knowledge? And so, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya met with Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to instruct him, and which he did for 7 days. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu the whole time just sat and listened and didn't say anything. So finally Bhattacharya asked him, I've been speaking about these topics for 7 days and you've been silent, so I'm not getting any feedback. I don't know whether you're understanding, not understanding, no questions. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, yes, I haven't asked anything. I understand the sutras very well, but I can't follow your explanations, because actually your explanations are just covering the meaning of Vedanta Sutra, the way the clouds cover the sun. So then, Sarvabhauma asked, then what's your understanding? What's your take on all of this? And now Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has been discussing that topic. The Vaibhav philosophy is prevalent everywhere. Today we were in one university, and although none of the students had formal training in Vedanta philosophy, several of them showed a sort of generic indoctrination with the impersonal ideas that lie at the core of Mahayana philosophy. We found the same thing. Well, in the last few university engagements we've done here and elsewhere, it keeps coming up, this persistent notion that the Supreme must be some sort of impersonal, unmanifested, homogeneous reality, devoid of form, qualities, name, variety, and so on. So that view was taught with philosophical complexity by Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, but it's in a sort of a pop version. It's present everywhere. And therefore, in Srila Prabhupada's Pranam Mantra, we find Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Vashtratadeshatari. His mission is to deliver the Western countries from Nirvisheshvad and Shunyavad, the idea that everything is finally lacking in variety or conspicuous by the absence of variety, or that everything is blank, is void. That was the word one student used today, was blank, trying to make his mind blank and reach a state of nothingness, really. That's shunya. Okay, so now we'll resume Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's reply to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. Try and arrange this thing so that it works and yet doesn't get between me and Dej. Okay, let's try that. Vedir Nugupta Artha Pujananda Hoy Purana Vakeshe Artha Kore Nishchoy. The confidential meaning of the Vedas is not easily understood by common men. Therefore, that meaning is supplemented by the words of the Puranas. There's a section of philosophers who insist, no, just the Vedas, just the Vedas. But in the Upanishads themselves, which are like the headlines of the Vedas, this is a very directional microphone, isn't it? Our temples generally have super directional microphones, which are the wrong kind for the purpose. Okay, let's do this. In which case, let's be good. In the Upanishads, which are the headlines of the Vedas, it's explicitly said that the Puranas and the Mahabharata are the fifth Veda. So if you argue from the Vedas that no, just the Vedas, well, the Vedas themselves say yes, and the Puranas and the Mahabharata. So now Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is going to quote from not only the Puranas, but particularly Srimad Bhagavatam Mahapurana. And here's what he says. Aho bhagyam, aho bhagyam, nanda gopa vrajaukasam, yam mitram paramanandam, purna brahma sanatanam. The discussion has been about param brahma, the supreme absolute truth, the greatest. Brahma means the greatest. And here's what Srimad Bhagavatam says about the greatest, about Brahma, about the absolute truth. How greatly fortunate are Nanda Maharaj, the cowherd men, and all the inhabitants of Brajabhumi. There's no limit to their fortune, because the absolute truth, the source of transcendental bliss, the eternal supreme Brahma, has become their friend. Yam mitram paramananda, param brahma sanatana. The impersonalist philosophers are pursuing the absolute, the supreme, the eternal, greatest truth. And that supreme, absolute truth has become the friend of Nanda Maharaj and the Brajvasis. Elsewhere, what is that? Another verse says that let others study the Upanishads and let them absorb themselves in reading the Smriti Shastras. I just want to worship Nanda Maharaj because the absolute truth is crawling in his yard. The impersonalists are unable to relish this wonderful feature of the absolute truth. They want to make the absolute truth something devoid of form, devoid of qualities, just practically devoid of everything. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has already said that the absolute truth is Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, ultimately. And that personality of Godhead is characterized by blissful transcendental relationships with his devotees. So, aho bhagya, bhagya means fortunate, and aho means just see, aho means my goodness. Aho bhagya, how great is the fortune of Nanda Maharaj and these inhabitants of Vrindavan, who have the absolute truth as their intimate friend. The mind-body philosophers are, Srila Prabhupada says elsewhere, maybe it comes up in this chapter or else it's in Prakashananda Saraswati, they're so dry philosophy. They're so dry that they're described as being like dry oil cakes without the oil. There's a picture in one of our volumes of Chaitanya Charitamrita of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu surrounded by the Mayavadi philosophies, and they look, philosophers, and they look just like that, all dry and austere. But the Vaishnavas are relishing these transcendental blissful relationships. Even the impersonalists sometimes take shelter of Srimad Bhagavatam just to get some juice. And then, of course, they interpret it in their own way and make a mess. But it's so dry, just the impersonal Brahma is so dry that they have to come looking for some nectar. Apanipada Shruti Varje Prakrita Pani Cholam Puna Kohe Shigra Chal Chole Kori Sarva Rama. The Vedic Apanipada mantra rejects material hands and legs. It states that the Lord goes fast, very fast, and accepts everything offered to him. Apanipado Javanagrihita. This is a statement from the Upanishads. So Lord Chaitanya, that verse is quoted by the Mayavadis. Apanipada, he has no hands, he has no legs. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, yes, he has no hands and legs. That means no material hands and legs. Because it also says that he walks very fast and accepts everything offered. What is that? In the Ishopanishad also? It's although situated in one place, he outruns everyone. Yes, the similar statements are made. Ataeva shruti kahe brahma savishesh mokyachari lakante nane nirvishesh. All these mantras confirm that the absolute truth is personal. The Mayavadis take these mantras inside, try to say, see, he has no hands, he has no legs. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, no, these mantras are trying to show you that he has hands, that he has legs. But they're not material hands and legs like ours. Well, all these mantras confirm that he's personal. But the Mayavadis, throwing away the direct meaning, interpret the absolute truth as impersonal. Mukhyachari, lakshanvani. They give up the direct meaning and they find some interpretive way of trying to establish an impersonal conclusion. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu condemns this. Shodashvaryu purhanam navigraha yaha hena bhagavane tumi kaha nirakar. Are you describing as formless that supreme personality of Godhead whose transcendental form is complete with six transcendental opulences? It's a rhetorical question because we know that's what he's doing. So Bhavika Team Shakti J Brahmahapai Brahmhewai Nishaktika Kari Tare Karahanakra. The Supreme Personality of Godhead has three primary potencies. Are you trying to prove that he has no potencies? Ultimately, if we have an absolute truth who has potencies, who has energies, then, as Mayavadi philosophers, we're in trouble. Because if everything is one, this young gentleman I was talking to today was trying to explain the realization that he's trying to achieve. And in that realization, everything is one. He had a little idea that this is Advaita Vedanta, everything is one. And, all right, then, if everything is one, where does illusion come from? As soon as you have the truth, you see, because everything is one, but we don't realize it because we're under illusion. When we're free from illusion, we'll see that everything is one. But if everything is one, and we don't see it because we're under illusion, where does the illusion come from? Oh, illusion is part of the absolute truth. The absolute truth has parts. It's not one anymore. It's supposed to be homogeneous oneness. So you can't have this part or that part. It's got to be all homogeneously one. So then try to explain it some other way, that but it comes back to the same thing, that there's somehow or other there's oneness, but we're not seeing oneness. If we're all one, this is a good question. Suppose we're all one, there's really no difference between you and me. Actually, you and I are identical, we're the same absolute truth. There is only one absolute truth. And so you and I are all equally that absolute truth. Everything's equally that absolute truth. Only because of illusion, I don't realize it and you don't realize it. But if I realize it, then you should immediately realize it. Right? If there's some big guru in India who's had this realization, then the whole world should have this realization. But we see that's not how it works. I'm under 80% illusion, you're under 60% illusion, someone's under 40%. It should all be 0% actually, because illusion and truth are the same. You can't make a distinction, it goes on like that. It's difficult to describe in words. That's one possibility, that it's just so inconceivably up there that words fail to describe it. The other possibility is, even at the basement level, it makes no sense. At the level where words work, obviously it doesn't mesh, it doesn't work. That's the actual position. So this philosophy is untenable. It's untenable. But these tenacious mind-body philosophers are persistently trying to push this conclusion, and people are accepting it uncritically. They pride themselves on being critical thinkers, and then they have this idea that, well, everything is all one, there's no difference between this and that and the other thing, but it makes no sense. Well, now Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is going to speak to this point, that when we speak of the absolute truth must have different energies. There's no meaning to the absolute truth without energies, just as there's no meaning to the sun without heat and light. Vishnu Shakti Paraprabdha, he's now going to quote four verses from the Vishnu Purana. Vishnu Shakti Paraprabdha Kshetra Gyatya Tata Para Avidya Karma Samganya Tritiya Shaktir Ishyate. The internal potency of the Supreme Lord, Vishnu, is spiritual, as verified by Shastras. And there's another spiritual potency known as Kshetrakya, or the living entity. The third potency, which is known as nescience, makes the living entity godless and fills him with fruit of activity. So here the Vishnu Purana is distinctly mentioning three energies of the Supreme Lord: the superior energy, the marginal energy, and then the material energy, which captures marginal living being and engages him in hard struggle for existence. So three energies of the Absolute Truth. We are energies of Krishna. That will be described further. Yaya Kshetragya. Kshetragya means the knower of the field. This body is the field of activities for the living being. And the person who's the knower of this field is Kshetragya, for the living entity. Yaya Kshetragya Shakti Sa Veshkita Nripasarvaga Samsara Tapan Akilan Avapnotyatra Santatan. Okay. Further quoting. Kshetrabhya Shakti is the living entity. Shakti means energy. Kshetrabhya Shakti is the living entity. Although he has the facility to live in either the material or the spiritual world, he suffers the threefold miseries of material existence because he's influenced by the avidya, Nesha's potency, which covers his constitutional position. Now this makes sense. I'm suffering in the material world because although I'm the superior energy of the Supreme Lord, I'm influenced by the inferior energy of the Supreme Lord. Where the different energies are working, and sometimes the superior energy, you know, the word marginal energy, comes under the sway of the inferior energy. Marginal energy means you can go either this way or that way. You can turn toward spirit or turn toward matter. Sometimes matter overtakes it. Just as one may be, my hand may be in light or it may be in shadow on my palm. So the living entity can come either under this energy or that energy, the superior energy or the inferior energy. All these different energies. Then that's why one person's liberated, one person's conditioned, because different energies are acting upon him, and he's one of the energies also. Taya tirobita tvachcha shakti kshetrakya sangita sarvabhuteshu bhupala taratam yena vartate. This living entity, covered by the influence of nescience, exists in different forms in the material condition. O king, he is thus proportionately freed from the influence of material energy to a greater or lesser extent. That's why we're not all liberated. Not when one of us is liberated, we're all liberated. Or when one of us is in conditioned life, we must all be conditioned. It's greater or lesser. Someone's more, every one of us would say that someone is somewhat less under illusion. Even the student has to think, well, the guy sitting next to me, he's totally out of it. He has no idea. I have a little bit of an idea, but I'm still not there yet. Somebody else, maybe in Rishikesh or something, has a greater understanding. That means it's proportionate. Some of us are more enlightened, some of us less, according to the degree by which we're covered by this avidya energy. Every one of us is individual, and therefore every one of us may be covered to a greater or lesser extent. It's not that we're all in the same position, all in the same standing. Ladini sandhini sangvit tvayeka sarvasanshraye ladata pakuri mishra tvayino gunavarjite. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is Satchidananda Vigraha, the form of eternity, bliss, and knowledge. This means that he originally has three potencies: the pleasure potency, the potency of eternality, and the potency of knowledge. Together, these are called the chit potency, the spiritual potency. And they are present in full in the Supreme Lord. For the living entities who are part and parcel of the Lord, the pleasure potency in the material world is sometimes displeasing and sometimes mixed. This is not the case with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because he's not under the influence of the material energy or its moves. But now again, we're finding it's sort of like a microscopic analysis. You look at the, say, an amoeba. And what's an amoeba? It's a blob. It's a blob. But now, with modern science, when you look at the amoeba under a powerful microscope, the blob turns out to be very complicated. It's got all of these different features. It's got, I don't know what it all has. But it's not just the blob that we thought. It has all these this fancy genetic stuff in it, mitochondria, and this and that and the other thing. All these structures which have Latin names to make life interesting. it's not all one. When you look at it carefully under the microscope, you see all these features. I'm sure you've all seen these films where you look at a drop of water, and a drop of water is just, you know, you look at it, it's like a bottle, and it's all water. But then you get in there with the electron microscope, and it's teeming with living beings, and it's full of life, and so on. So, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is looking at the absolute truth, which to the Maya bodies appears like a blob. You know, it appears to be just one undifferentiated substance. No variety, no form, no qualities, no nothing. And when he's examining it in the light of Shastra, he's finding that there's so many energies. He's analyzed one way and said, material energy, spiritual energy, marginal energy. Now he's looking in another way and saying, the energy of existence, the energy of knowledge, the energy of pleasure. Well, whichever way you look at it, the absolute truth is full of energies, Vividaya Shruta. Satchit Anandamay, Hoy Ishar Sarup, Tin Angshe Chitchakti, Hoy Tin Rup. The Supreme Personality of Godhead in His original form is full of eternity, bliss, and knowledge. The spiritual potency in these three portions, Satchit Ananda, assumes three different forms. So he's Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is essentially just paraphrasing that Sanskrit verse. Anandamshe ladini, shadamshe sandini, chidamshe sambit, yare gyan kurima. The three portions of the spiritual potency are called ladini, the bliss part, the bliss portion, sandini, the eternity portion, and sambit, the knowledge portion. We accept knowledge of these as full knowledge of the Supreme Personality of God. So again, Lord Chaitanya is saying energies. The Lord has, although he's one, he has parts. Although he's one undivided substance, still he has variegated energies. Antaranga chitshakti tatasta jivashakti varimanga mai tine kore premahakti. The spiritual potency of the personality of Godhead also appears in three phases, internal, marginal, and external. These are all engaged in his devotional service in love. So he's saying the Lord has spiritual potency. Now we can take that potency and divide it up into three, or analyze it in terms of three different energies. The Lord has one energy, you can call it spiritual energy. But now if we look at that spiritual energy, we'll find that it has different portions. Here, internal, marginal, external. Just as if you look at in the bank, you'll find maybe one big pile of money. But then if you analyze it, this part of the money belongs to this customer, that part belongs to that customer. Or you look at your own money, it's all one big pile of money, but this is your food budget, this is your travel budget, this is the rent. It's all one, and yet it's going to be applied in different ways. And so this part becomes the rent money, this part becomes the travel money. So the Lord has different energies which he deploys for different purposes. Shadvita Aisharya Prabhur Chitshakti Vilas Hena Shakti Nahiman Parama Sahas. In his spiritual potency, the Supreme Lord enjoys six kinds of opulences. You don't accept this spiritual potency. And this is due to your great impudence. Well, this is called laying it on the line. Lord Chaitanya directly says that not to reject, to refuse to accept the Lord's spiritual energies is simply to be obstinate. Mayatisha mayabash Ishare jivepev Hena jive ishar saha kaha ta ape. The Lord is the master of the potencies, Mayadhisha. And the Lord's the servant of them, Mayavash. That's the difference between the Lord and the living entity. But you declare that the Lord and the living entities are one and the same. Now, isn't that impudent? The king is in charge of the government, and we're under the government. And someone says, well, we're the same as the king. Yeah? Is that impudent or what? So that's Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's statement, that you're trying to equate the all-powerful and the person who simply belongs to one portion of the Lord's power. Well, this is impudent. Simply impudent. Paramasas. Gita Shastre Jiva Rupa Shakti Kodimani Hena Jiva Bhed Kola Ishara Shani. In the Bhagavad Gita, the living entity is established as the marginal potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That you say that the living entity is completely different from the Lord. But this is another way of going to make the living being either entirely one with the Lord or entirely different from the Lord. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teaching is that there's oneness and difference simultaneously. We're one with the Lord in quantity, in quality. The Lord is spiritual, we're also spiritual. And the Lord is eternal, we're also eternal. But we're quantitatively different. The Lord is great, and we're small. Bhumirapo nalo vayu kammano buddhire vacha ahankara tiya me dinna prakriti rashvata. Where's this from? Bhagavad Gita. Where?
Seventh chapter.
Earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego are my separated eightfold energies. And now we're getting into the material energy. We find that, well, first we divided the spiritual energy. We said it has three parts: spiritual, marginal, and material. Material energy is actually a subdivision of the spiritual energy, acting contrary to that. Now we get into the material energy, we find out that it has eight divisions. Each one of those is a separate energy. Aparayam itastvanyam prakritim vidhime pranam jiva bhutam mahabhaho yayam tarvatejana. Besides these inferior energies, which are material, there's another energy, a spiritual energy. And this is the living being, Almighty Arjuna. The entire material world is sustained by living entities. Sustained by the living entities means just like this body. It's sustained by the presence of the living being within the body. Ultimately, everything is sustained by Krishna. Ishwara Sri Vigra Sachidananda Kara She Vigraha Tava Sattva Gunair Bikara. The transcendental form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is complete in eternity, cognizance, and bliss. But you describe this transcendental form as a product of material goodness. This is we get deep into Shankaracharya's presentation of Mayavada philosophy. He proposes that the form of Bhagavan, or the personality of Godhead, is a manifestation of the material world of goodness. Or even sometimes the Mayavad say is the sum total of the ignorance appears as the Supreme Lord. Impudence upon impudence. Anyway, to get into how Shankaracharya arrives at that tricky sort of proposition is more than we'll try to do today. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu clearly rejects this. Sri Vigraha Jai Namani Shaita Pashandi Adrishya Asprishya Shaihoi Yamadandi. One who doesn't accept the transcendental form of the Lord is certainly an agnostic. agnostic we have sort of in our, we have the idea that an agnostic is sort of a person who's undecided about whether there's God or whether there's not God. Srila Prabhupada uses the word in a different sort of sense here, it seems. Pashyati is more like a, what would you say a Pashyati is? An infidel. That's really what a Pashyati is. It's more than an agnostic. Agnostic is a person who can't quite make up his mind. But a Pashyati is a person who's really an infidel. A rebel. What's the word? Yeah. It's like in the news, what do they call those people? Extremist factions. So like a Pashyati is like that. He's like a materialistic, rebellious, extremist. So and so. And he's subject, such a person should be neither seen nor touched. That's what kind of person he is. An agnostic, we can see him. But Pashyati is such a person who shouldn't even, you touch him, you'll get the cooties, you'll get contaminated. And if you see him, then you should just take a bath in the river with all your clothes. He's so contaminated. And he's subject to be punished by Yamaraj, the king of death. Veda na maniya bodha bhaita nastik, ve ashraya nastik yavad, bodhake atik. The Buddhists don't recognize the authority of the Vedas, therefore they're considered agnostics, or what is it, agnostic? Gnostic, how does Prabhupada translate? Yeah, agnostics. But it's, again, there's rather infidels. Yeah, they're rebels. Their Buddhist philosophy is a kind of rebellion against Vedic philosophy, because Lord Buddha rejected the Vedic authority. It's like if you reject, like Upanti rejected British law. That makes you a rebel. The Americans, the people of the American Revolution, they rejected British law. So that made them rebels. The Civil War in America, the South rejected the federal law, so that made them rebels. Of course, one man's rebel is another man's hero in the material world. But when you're a rebel against the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then you're an infidel. So the Buddhists reject the Vedic authority. They say these Vedic scriptures, because Lord Buddha saw people are using these Vedic scriptures simply to justify wholesale animal killing. And he wanted to establish ahimsa, which is actually the Vedic teaching. So rather than saying, no, the Vedas teach this, he rejected the Vedas and started over again. He said, no, you should follow this ahimsa. But it does make the Buddhists rebels against the Vedic authority. So they're Pashyatis or Nasti. But those who've taken shelter of the Vedic scriptures and yet preach agnosticism or Mayavad philosophy are more dangerous than the Buddhists. Bodhake Atik. The Buddhists are against the Vedic authority, but the Mayavadis who superficially accept the Vedic authority but reject the personality of Godhead, they're more far gone than the Buddhists. That's what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was saying. They're more dangerous than the Buddhists because they appear like a spy, a person who's against your country, okay, he's an enemy, but a person who's a spy, he's a more dangerous enemy. He's pretending that he's still working for the country, but he's really working for the country's enemies. So the Buddhists are straightforward, that we reject the Vedas. And the Mayavadis, no, we accept the Vedas, we accept the Vedas. And what are you teaching, Buddhism? for? So they're more dangerous. Jivir Nishtar Lagi Shutra Koyo Vyas Mayabadi Pasha Shunile Hoy Sarvanash. Srila Vyasadeva, the author of the Vedic literature, presented the Vedanta philosophy for the deliverance of conditioned souls. But if one hears the commentary of Shankaracharya, everything is spoiled. Srila Prabhupada very often quoted this line, Mayavadi Bhasha Shunile Hoy Sarvanasha. The Mayavadi philosophy is so infectious that if one hears that philosophy, if one becomes a student of Mayavadi philosophy, if one goes and listens to discourses on Mayavadi philosophy, it's so pernicious that one can lose everything. It's all spiritual. Understanding can be ruined. Therefore, Lord Chaitanya strictly forbid us to hear from the Mayavadis. Mayavadi Pasha, Mayavadi commentary, shouldn't be hearing Sarvanasha. One is ruined. One shouldn't hear from the Mayavadis. Parinam Vad, Vyas Sutra Samvat. Somatam, Achintya Shakti Isha Jagat Upe Parinatam. The Vedanta Sutra aims at establishing that the cosmic manifestation has come into being by the transformation of the inconceivable potency of the Supreme Personality of God. This is the teaching, actual teaching of Vyasadeva. The Lord has various energies and they transform in various ways to give us all the varieties that we see. Mani, Yoiche Avrakrite Prasabe Hemapar Jagat Rupohai Ishar Tabu Avikar. He's quoting. This is a quotation? No, he's just saying this. The touchstone, after touching iron, produces volumes of gold without being changed. Similarly, the Supreme Personality of Godhead manifests himself as the cosmic manifestation by his inconceivable potency. Yet he remains unchanged in his eternal transcendental form. Purnasya Purna Adaya Purna Vena Vishishitaya. Vishopanishad said, so many, the whole cosmic manifestation comes from him, and yet he remains as he is. His potency is being transformed in so many ways. But the Lord remains the same. Vyas Prantavali, we're just about reaching the end of Lord Chaitanya's goodbye to Sarvabhauma. Vyas Prantavali, She, Shutre Doshadhyā, Vivartabad, Stapiyachi, Kalpana Koya. Shankaracharya's theory says that the absolute truth is transformed. The Vyasadeva says that his energies are transformed. They say that he's transformed. That the absolute truth is somehow transformed into, because everything is one. So whatever you see is somehow a transformation of the absolute truth. No, it's his energy. So by accepting this theory, the Mayavadi philosophers denigrate Srila Vyasadeva by accusing him of error. Thus they find fault in the Vedanta Sutra and interpret it to try to establish the theory of illusion. This gets to be a very complex discussion, which is undertaken to a greater extent in the Adi Lila of Chaitanya Charitamrita. To get into all the ins and outs of it would require a deeper study of Mayavad philosophy than we're prepared to go into this evening. But in summary, instead of accepting, as soon as you don't accept the energies of the absolute truth, or as soon as you do accept the energies, then the whole world is easily explained as being a manifestation of his energies, just as something is manifest by heat or by light. The rainfall is manifest by light, manifest in variety. But if you want to accept, if you want to say that the absolute truth somehow is transformed into different varieties, then what happens to the absolute truth himself? So it's a very strange philosophy they've got there. And of course they say, well, the absolute truth is really one, but by illusion it seems that there's variety. Really there's no variety but illusion. Then again, where does the illusion come from? So they've got this idea of illusion. That's sort of the magic element that makes everything work. But where does that illusion come from? Jivar dehe atma bhuti she mityahoy jagat ye mityanahi nashra matrohoy. The theory of illusion can apply when the living entity identifies himself with the body. Now that's illusion. When I think that I'm American, or I'm Indian, or I'm African, or I'm white, or I'm black, or I'm old, or I'm young. Now that's illusion, because I'm thinking I'm something I'm not. When we mistake a rope for a snake, now that's an illusion. The rope is not a snake. I'm not this body. So there's a proper place for the idea of illusion. As far as the cosmic manifestation is concerned, it cannot be called false, although it's certainly temporary. They try to say that the cosmic manifestation is an illusion. But it, you know, and yet, if you try to walk through the wall, you're going to have an awfully hard time. I remember trying to, when I was in my teens, I was also influenced by the Mahayana philosophy. Everything is one, and yet I was trying to think that, well, you know, the wall is rather tangibly there. How is it that, you know, and can I reach like a certain state of elevated consciousness in which the wall will really no longer exist? I never did. You know, it's there, but it's not what we think it is. That's all. It's not false. Not that the cosmic manifestation, because that's how they tried. Everything's really one. You're only thinking that there's a world here. You're only thinking that there's yellow and blue and red and green. You're only thinking that there's me and you and the next guy. You're only thinking that so many varieties exist. How are you thinking that? By illusion. Nothing is real. It's only illusion. That's there. Their idea. But if the truth is real, how does the world become illusory? If everything comes from the truth, how does this world, which comes from the truth, wind up being illusory? And again, where does this illusion come from? Well, the illusory potency is one of the potencies of the word, Maya Shakti, by which we fall under illusion and we think, I'm this body, I'm this. The idea of illusion has its place. But the idea that everything is illusion, so Chaitanya Mahaprabhu rejects it. Now he just has one more comment and a couple more verses. Pranavajay Mahabhakya Ishwar Murti Pranabhoite sarvabhed jagat utpatti. The transcendental vibration, Omkar, is the sound form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. All Vedic knowledge and this cosmic manifestation are produced from this sound representation of the Supreme Lord. This Omkar, the syllable Om, Pranava sarvabhed eshu. In all the Vedas, this syllable Om represents Krishna. So this Omkar is the real Mahabhakya. The Mahabhakya means the big word in the Vedas is Omkar. God. Tattvamasi jiva hetu prayasheka bhakya pralav na mani tare kohe mahavakya. But there's another vibration in the Vedic literature, tattvamasi. You are that. Which is meant for the understanding of the living entity. But the main vibration is omkar. Not caring for omkar, Shankara has stressed tattvamasi. This is, you know, you pull a slogan and you just start waving it like a flag. The big word in the Vedas is om. But they look and they look and they find, someplace, tattvamasi. And then they hoist that up the flagpole. And they make that the big slogan, as if all the Vedas are trying to tell you that you are the same as the Supreme. You are the same as the Supreme, but only in quality, not in quantity. E mate kalpita pashe shatadosha dila patacharja purva paksha apar koriya. Thus, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu criticized Shankaracharya's Sharira Pasha, his commentary on Vedanta, as imaginary. And he pointed out hundreds of faults in it. To defend Shankaracharya, however, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya presented unlimited opposition, which of course Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu refuted. So that's the main portion of Lord Chaitanya's philosophical demolition job on Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's exposition of Vedanta Sutra, and we'll continue the discussion tomorrow. We have any questions?
Amongst the personalist philosophers like Madhvacharya, Ramanujacharya, and then Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, what are the subtle differences that are culminating in Vedic?
What are the subtle differences between the acharyas who oppose Shankaracharya, Ramanuja Acharya, Madhvacharya, Nirvaka Acharya? They have different philosophies. Shankaracharya called his philosophy Kevaladutta, Kevaladutta, absolute monism, pure oneness. Then the Madhvacharya has Dvaita philosophy, as Shankara has Advaita, Madhva has Dvaita. The Shankara says everything is one, and Madhva holds up his hand like this and says, no, everything is two. You may have seen the poster of Madhvacharya. He has his hands this way. It's not like Winston Churchill. It's, it has a different purpose. Everything is two. So he's counteracting. He's opposing Shankara, saying, no, there's difference. There's difference between the Lord and the living entity. There's difference between the Lord and material nature. There's difference between the living entity and material nature. Difference between essence, between the Lord and the living entity. Everything, there's difference all over the place. So in that way, he opposes Shankaracharya. Then Ramanuja has Vishishtadvaita. He says there's oneness, but there's distinction within that oneness. So again, he's essentially opposing Shankaracharya. Not insisting on insisting on the absolute duality of everything, but insisting that within oneness there's distinctions. Vishishta means speciality. Now I have gone into actually a study of the Vedanta commentaries of these different acharyas, Ramanuja and so on. It would take quite a bit. It would be quite a piece of work. But the summary is that they're all, you know, sometimes, like some Mayavadi comes to a Sunday feast, and one of our men will get on him and start arguing from one position, one angle of vision. Then after a while, he's tired of arguing with the guy, and then the next devotee comes, and he argues from sort of a different angle. And then another person comes, after this second person's given off or had enough of it, and comes and angles, third angle of vision. So someone may say, well, these three devotees actually have three different angles of vision. It's actually the same angle, the same point. The guy is wrong. And they're just demonstrating it by taking a different tack. So Ramanuja and Madhva, sometimes scholars try to make out that Ramanuja is at war with Madhva, Madhva is at war with Nibbarka. Actually, they're all at war with Shankara. Okay. Somebody else?
Yeah. One of the verses you read said that his internal, Krishna's internal, marginal, and external potency are all
serving the Lord.
In loving
the Lord. In loving service.
And in the Gita, Krishna says that everyone is serving me in all respects, but doesn't say lovingly. How can his marginal, how can all of his marginal be lovingly serving him?
Bhakti. Let's look at it. It's love perverted and misdirected. Let's see what he says. I do remember that verse. They're all engaged in his devotional service in prema bhakti. Tina kvade prema bhakti. Of course, this is the Uttamadhikari vision. Sees that everyone's serving Krishna. Only I'm not serving Krishna. That's the vision of a pure devotee. But even Maya is serving the Lord in devotion.
The Maya is clear.
When freed, the living entity... Oh, okay. Prabhupada qualifies it. When freed, the living entity awakens to Krishna consciousness and engages in devotional service with love and affection. But it's constitutionally, there are three energies, internal, marginal, and external. Marginal energy, when it's in its right position, serves with love and devotion. It's just when he's affected by Maya that he doesn't. It's like a person. He walks, he talks, he eats. That's what a person does. But when he's sick, he doesn't walk, he may not be able to talk very well, he can hardly eat. But the natural position is he walks, he talks, he eats. And the natural position of the living being is that he serves Krishna with love. But when he's in his disease condition, then he doesn't. Okay.
And one other thing, Mark, is we're speaking about Mayavad philosophy, almost childishly, like it's so simple. But the following is so big, and amongst the following is so many intelligent people. And some of them are serious spiritual seekers. It's not that.
Following is so big. Well, first of all, that doesn't count for anything. You know, Madonna has more followers than Socrates. That doesn't make her a better philosopher.
No, but there's not something inherently stupid about Madonna. Right? What I mean to say is that there's not something about Madonna that doesn't make sense.
Well, I don't want to comment on Madonna, whether or not she makes sense. Shankaracharya certainly doesn't. Madonna. So, Madonna Tattva is a little bit beyond my area of expertise. She's after my time, to tell you the truth. But I can tell you, in fairness to Madonna, she shops at Govinda's in Los Angeles. So she's not telling us anything bad about our customers. Yes, what was your point there before we got sidetracked by the time?
There are mass followings of people, that's fine, but this is a mass following of something which we're writing off as simply illogical at a fundamental level. So how is that?
How is it that some people, that so many intelligent people, how can we be writing it off as illogical that so many intelligent people follow it?
Yeah, even like the Nipata will agree with this. This is like such
yeah.
a basic.
So our point is that if you put your yes, our point is that the so-called intelligent people are not as smart as they make themselves out to be, or as we think they are. The Prabhupada asks that question when Krishna says, "Namadushkritinabhuta," that these people are fools. And he says, "You mean to say these great scientists, great philosophers, great political leaders are all fools?" Yes. He says, "Yes." It's taken as, you know, a great person is a great thoughtful person, he's a great thinker, a great philosopher, he's a great spiritual teacher. And when you look at what he's teaching, it's Mayavad. And it's fundamentally bad. Everything is one. That sounds so deep, so profound, so be here now. But when you look at it, it falls apart. If everything is one, why don't you agree with me?
Well, what do they answer? They must have an answer.
They have answers and answers and answers. But we don't agree with their answers, and therefore everything is not one.
If one of our devotees made such a simple point to them,
it's amazing how they'll go on. They're like, if you've ever tried to nail jello to the wall. That's what it's like trying to deal with these people. They just you pull apart their argument so that it's like lying there on the floor smashed, and they smile at you with this deep cosmic. There's something you don't know.
Because of the taste that they're getting from the practice?
Because of the taste they're getting? No, because they're dull. You know, like a person who's got some sort of a physiological condition, so that if you stick a pin in his hand, he doesn't notice it. Their philosophy is just been shot full of holes, and they don't get it. They just in various places we sometimes meet these people in great numbers, and they're just impervious to logic. They'll take shelter. Well, it's beyond words. It's beyond. Well, then you can't say anything about that. They're full of words until their philosophy falls apart. Then it's really words. You can't describe it in words. The words were perfectly good until your words defeated their words. Again, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mother, his mother, defeated this philosophy. That when I want to carry water, it's all right that mud in the form of a pitcher and mud in the form of a brick are the same, but I can't carry water in a brick. I have to use the pitcher. Simple thing. Anyone can understand it. If everything's one, why don't you eat garbage? Excuse me?
Because they're not at that level of realization.
No, they're not, nor would they want to be on that level of realization. Everything's one. Everything is so manifestly not one. And yet they're insisting that everything is one. There's difference between you and me. And you're saying everything's one, I'm saying everything's different. Right away, difference wins. We'll say, well, that's just because of illusion. Well, truth and illusion. Count it up. Why do so many people stick to it? Because they're trying to avoid Krishna. When the cat's away, the mice will play. And the mice want to believe that there's no cat. That's really what it's. It's like you say, in so many ways. Because they want to go on. What is that? There was a Beatles song. Nothing is real and nothing to get hung about. The world is an illusion, so you might as well enjoy it. Nothing to get hung up about, nothing to bother about, nothing to worry about. Everything's an illusion, so just do whatever you want. God is just an illusion, another one of those concepts. But don't worry about him. Especially if he's getting in the way of your fun. Everything is one, but they seek out very particular kinds of sense gratification. Everything is one. How come, everything is one. Everything is one. Well, they won't let me enjoy my senses. Everything is one, but they have no difficulty figuring out the difference between a monastery and a brothel. And they're not heading in large numbers, of course, to a monastery. Why do so many people accept it? Because it links up with their idea of sense gratification. They want sense gratification because that's the purpose of life. And they want to have a philosophy because everyone has to have a philosophy. And this is a philosophy that will work well with my idea of sense gratification. Well, I can do anything because Zendro is all one anyway. Which isn't Shankara's philosophy. The actual followers of Shankaracharya are rigid. They see the world is actually illusory and they want to escape from this duality on which sense gratification depends. But that's Shankaracharya's strict. They want Shankaracharya life. Pop Shankara. None of them would actually be ready to go for what Shankara, to get started in spiritual life according to Shankaracharya. What's item one? Give up sex. They'd rather give up Shankaracharya. So a good Mayavadi is hard to find in Kali Yuga. You get pop, psychology. To find a real psychologist is one thing. But pop psychology, you go to the drugstore and there's, 100 books about how to get in touch with yourself, how to be deeper, how to, about Venus and Mars and all this kind of popular stuff where you don't really have to work very hard to understand anything that psychology is about. You just have to have something breezy and light and suitable for your taste buds. So the modern Mayavada philosophy is rather a disgrace even to Mayavada philosophy. It's just a sort of a breezy, popular version in which a few slogans are thrown around. And it's all one. It's all illusion. Be here now. Whatever you think, that's what it is. And that's taken as awesome. That's an awesome realization. That's a deep realization. It's stupid, really. But since when is that a problem? What goes for philosophy in Kali Yuga is pitiful. And then it gets glorified in different ways. This sort of new agey, we're all one philosophy it wears pretty thin, but then someone goes into trance and hears it from a departed, discarnate spirit, and now is suddenly invested with new pedigree. Now it was getting kind of thin, but then now it's revived its profundity because some ghost told it to me. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, angels, right. I heard it from an angel. It's amazing, these angels and discarnate spirits and descended masters and all this kind of stuff. How come they all deal in the same sort of pattern? If you were really getting a descended master, a deeply realized entity who'd come from 5,000 years ago or something, through a mediumistic channel to set the world free, you'd think he'd have a new message, but no, it's the same old pop Mayavad philosophy. Same thin diet of oatmeal and white wine. Something else. Yes?
Would it be a fair statement that serious adherence and attachment to impersonal philosophy arises from envy of Krishna? And if so, how is it that that envy goes to the extent where one actually wants to destroy the real self, lose one's identity completely?
Well, how is it that this, and is it a fair statement that this Mayavad philosophy comes from envy of Krishna? And so how could it go so far as that we want to destroy our own selves? We see that practically. And in ordinary dealings, when one child is envious of another, Timmy's got the toy that I want. So I'll go to the point that I'll destroy the toy. Before Timmy can enjoy it, let it be smashed. That's the nature of envy. That's the nature of envy. People will go to such lengths out of envy of Krishna. Yes. Stand the idea that Krishna should be in charge. They'll, rather than have Krishna be in charge, they'll invent a philosophy where no one's in charge. That'll fix him. It doesn't work. But they so much resent the idea that someone other than them, other than they is in charge, other than them, that they'll come to a philosophy where, well, no one's in charge. I lost the election, and so now I come up with the idea that no one was elected. If I'd won, it wouldn't have been a problem. Something like that. I just can't stand the idea that it's someone other than them. If I can't be president, I'll blow up the country. Right? They'll plunge a country, plunge their own country into war if they can't be the president. If they can be the president, that's fine. If they can't be the president, they'll tear up the whole country. 10 million people can die. That's fine. As long as that guy isn't president. That's envy. Guy falls in love with the girl jilts him, he shoots the girl. Right? Rather than let the girl be in love with someone else, he'd rather see the girl dead. That's envy. Well, The original envy is envy of Krishna. Big time envy. Why should Krishna enjoy? There's no God. Or God has no form, God has no qualities, God has no, which is the same as there's no God. If I can't be the enjoyer, no one can. Is there another question there?
Does this philosophy ultimately come from Krishna? Through
yeah, everything comes from Krishna. Life comes from Krishna also.
Through Lord Shiva?
Yeah, from Shankaracharya.
Was he directed to do this? And that's
yeah, it moves Kali Yuga right along.
So is that why maybe because that Shakti is actually coming from
Krishna? Yeah, that's another answer to the question. How could Mayavad philosophy be so popular? Well, here we are in Kali Yuga. It's the philosophy for the age. Krishna is pushing Kali Yuga, so he's pushing Mayavad philosophy. That means can't have Kali Yuga without lots and lots of Mayavad philosophy. Everything is one. So we can do any damn thing. Where everything is one, so who cares? That's another way of looking at it. If the truth is all one, it's really uninteresting. If the absolute truth is that finally there's no individuality, there's no form, there's no quality, there's no name, there's no activity, then, you know, Times Square on a Saturday night is more interesting. Times Square is the big entertainment spot in New York City. And the material world is more interesting than the spiritual world. The spiritual world is just monotonous, absolutely monotonous. A teenager calls another teenager on the phone. What are you doing? Well, nothing really. What are you doing? Well, nothing really. What's happened? Well, nothing's happened. That means life is so dull, life is so boring, life is just, you know, nothing's happening. That's depression. So if the spiritual world is one big cosmic nothing's happening, then the spiritual world, the material world, starts to look attractive by comparison. Even the pious ideas of heaven, where all right, there's individuality, but because there's no knowledge of spiritual pastimes, it's boring. And what do you do when you go to heaven? You float around in the clouds and play a harp all day. It's boring. What is attractive about that? Well, Krishna is all attractive because there's so many variegated pastimes, all in relation to the absolute truth. But heaven is boring, and Mayavad is absolutely boring. It's rigid monotony. Therefore, no one can stay in that position. Even if one somehow attains it, after great trouble, it falls down because there's nothing there. There's a famous comment by one American writer explaining why she, after leaving New York for California, came back to New York. She said there was no there there. The same thing could be said about the impersonal realm, impersonal absolute. There's no there there, there's nothing there. It's as good as void. Anything else? Yes?
When we're engaged in a conversation with my philosopher or student, and we can see that it's just a situation of banging your head against a brick wall, they're going to walk away with that smile.
Yeah, friends for some time.
Sorry,
prasadam time or time for kirtan. Fortunately, we have more in our arsenal than just philosophy. These Mayavadis are impervious to philosophy, but rarely do you meet a philosopher and Mayavadi who's impervious to prasad. Everything is one, but our food is better than the little kirtan? You're the kirtan, yeah. I missed that first kirtan, but it sounded pretty nice.
This is the kirtan. This is the kirtan.
Krishna, Krishna.